all the fiscal climate we are anticipating at this point, most of it. If you have some thoughts and ideas on, and we have heard about the concept, actually the concept and some draft of strategic pathways, now is the chance for us to encourage faculty to go and provide their input or the public during the public comment period, so that we can provide our opinion about how this strategic pathway or the fiscal environment can be eased. So that's one thing. 18th and 19th, it will be morning, perhaps around. I haven't seen the agenda yet, so it should be around 9 a.m. in the morning. Anyway, the other one is Chancellor search. We had 41 applicants, and that's great. We have a meeting on February 10th where a short list of 8 will be prepared, and it's still not finalized. At least 8. Sorry, I shouldn't say 8, but at least 8 candidates. Then Planning and Budget Committee, we had for the this week, I think. No, last week, I'm sorry. Last week, we had the Planning and Budget Committee and a meeting where we had some initial discussion on planning for the FY17 that will use input from each of the vice chancellor's budget, and that's still a preliminary discussion we had. Nothing has progressed beyond that. We had the Faculty Alliance retreat on January 23rd, and that's when the first time we heard from the summit team. There was the first 1.5 hours was a joint meeting with the summit team, where we heard about the strategic pathways concept from President Johnson and the other team members. Besides that, the rest of the day was spent on developing goals, opportunities, and responsibilities of the Faculty Alliance. Keeping in mind that UA will see major financial issues in the short term and possibly in the long term. The only other thing that I want to bring to your note is the grade appeals. Grade appeals have increased significantly this year compared to last academic year. This academic year, I'm talking about. It's an order of magnitude more, and I don't know why it has happened. And as a corollary also, I had a discussion with Amber from the Dean of Students Office on February 3 about this. As a discussion aside, we also talked about the developing academic misconduct policy, where Orion is taking the lead on that one. But I have requested Amber to give us some skeleton, which will then be reviewed by the provost's office, probably Alex, and then it comes to the Faculty Senate. So that will be a natural progression where Faculty Senate committee, some committee, will look into it in more depth. Thank you. Any questions? All right, I'll let you think through it. Let Orion speak.
Yeah, so I have to say, I actually really like the way the strategic pathways plan is coming out. That at the moment, it sounds pretty vague, and I think it's because it is pretty vague. So this is our chance to kind of influence how it's actually going to look and the gory details, which are the important thing about how this is gonna actually come out. So I mean, I definitely get the impression that the leadership is ready and willing to hear faculty voice, and I mean, we all know we need really good, you know, innovative ideas to figure out how to actually get done what we need to get done, and how to be, you know, in a good place 5 years from now, and this is the time to make those decisions. So I've definitely got several different things on my plate. The student academic misconduct policy, I'm definitely still looking for volunteers on that, so let me know. Okay.
That's it. Thank you. Any questions for either of us? All right. Now may I request Chancellor Powers for his remarks.
Thank you, Debu. This is on, right? Yep. A couple of quick announcements. First and foremost, Larry Hinsman's been named Vice Chancellor for Research, and it's interesting when an announcement like that is made. Certainly the first comments are coming from the campus and then the community and then the state, and then you hear some D.C. comments, and I understand internationally clearly a widely respected expert in the Arctic, and we're delighted that that he is Vice Chancellor for Research. Just to follow up on the Board of Regents meeting on the 18th and 19th, typically 3 minutes of testimony. I suspect this will be a fairly full agenda. You may even want to think in terms of 2 minutes. It's so powerful, and I say this frequently, to use that testimony time as a way to get an idea or a thought or a concern across, but really pay attention to those time limits. I know they'll be moving quickly. In the same breath, I would encourage you to come forth and be sure to testify, if time allows, on any concerns you may have. I suspect the strategic pathways will be taking up, you know, quite a bit of the discussion. On Tuesday, February 23rd, so this the Thursday and Friday will be the Regents meetings, and then the next week on Tuesday we'll have we're hosting a Chancellor's Forum, 1 to 2:30 in the Wood Center, and we'll hopefully have some more information to share about the strategic pathways at that point, as well as other questions. To follow up on a point that Debu had made is the faculty retreat first heard about this January 23rd. We first heard about this the day before, January 22nd. So this concept of strategic pathways, alignment, efficiencies within the system is just coming to the forefront now. And I would like to reiterate, as I look at the document, the conceptual framework being analyzed, certainly some changes in the weeks and months ahead, and maybe implemented before the end of the fiscal year, and then over the next couple of years. There's an opportunity for shaping this, so be sure to come forward. And, of course, the top of this is Strategic Pathways 2016-2025. We're talking long-term here. Now, what those immediate changes may be, we don't know. Opportunity at the Regents meeting in writing through various forums to have your voice heard. The Cabinet are working through some questions. We've been working, you know, every weekend since 2 weeks ago, trying to shape this a little bit more, get a better understanding. Tomorrow we have a summit meeting. We'll have greater clarity, and we'll be able to bring that forward, as I mentioned, on the 23rd for that Chancellor's Forum. In the meantime, even though we're looking out to 2025, there's the FY17 budget before us that is being worked aggressively. January to April is the bulk of the work of the Planning and Budget Committee, and then we're expecting in April to see some legislative recommendations, and you know, very concerned it'll be greater cuts than what the governor has proposed. But we will be ready as we work through that, and we'll begin to ramp up the communication. Again, I want to reiterate on the pathways, we just saw this recently, so trying to keep timely information out there will be a challenge, but we'll do our very best. It's only respectful, appropriate, and part of the shared governance process. On the capital, engineering remains number one capital priority, even out of Anchorage. $121 million project, 75 secured, $46 million remains unfunded. And then the combined heat and power will restart March 1st. Design's 47% complete. That funding has been secured. So that's just a quick update, and would encourage you to stay engaged with the various opportunities, the forum, letters, various meetings, regents meetings, et cetera. Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor Powers. Any questions for him?
I have a question. I was wondering, I know that the different colleges are putting together different sort of scenarios depending on what the budget looks like. Is it possible for that to be more transparent in terms of faculty and other staff seeing what those various scenarios would look like, just so we can prepare as well?
So, Susan, I'm going to have to defer to you on this one.
We are planning to give those plans to the Planning and Budget Committee soon for assessment. At that time, we will, or at about that time, the amount of work is significant, but as soon as we can, we will get a version of the unit proposals out for people to look at. There are some, not too many, but there are some particular things that involve individual staff layoffs or changes like that. And those need to remain confidential until the individual is notified. So we won't be providing plans with position by position at that time. But we will try to provide plans that give people a reasonably good idea of what changes on a larger scale that they might expect in their respective units as a result of the budget reductions. The Planning and Budget Committee will review those proposed changes and make recommendations to Chancellor's Cabinet. And also, of course, Chancellor's Cabinet will be prepared to receive input from others based on what they see in the plans and the concerns that they may have about those plans. However, is, of course, the overlay of strategic pathways, which I'll say a little bit more when I get into my comments.
Thank you, Provost Hendricks. I think Chancellor Powers had a comment.
I'll just add again the timeliness of this information getting out. So, again, on the pathways, Friday the 22nd, we first heard about this. Saturday the 23rd, discuss this at the faculty retreat. Then Jim Johnson goes into the hospital, and so now we have another challenge in front of us, just with some communication. What I'll do with tomorrow's summit, and then looking forward to next week, is try to get a calendar of some of this information lined out for next Tuesday at that Chancellor's forum. So at least we can give you a calendar of what some of these announcements look like.
Thank you. Provost Hendricks, your comments, please.
Was there another question over there?
Oh, is there a question? Sorry, Ken.
Yes. The pathways outline is out there on the website right now, but it's silent on the lead institutions for the different areas. Can you shed any light on that? And if you can't, could you give us a timeline when we might be able to learn more about that?
As you probably saw in the Pathways document, it mentions the definition of these lead universities still very much up in the air. So we're uncertain to a certain extent, too. We should have some information tomorrow, and I can press the need, the call for this, you know, this announcement and bring it back to Tuesday. As a general focus relative to research, UAA has been identified as for discussion conceptually, social and policy sciences, UAF, science and engineering, and UAS, interdisciplinary environmental. Under teaching, education is still held in all three campuses. That's been a fairly controversial area. No real decision yet. we go back and forth on the effectiveness. Is one campus or three the best approach? And that's very much up in the air. Same with engineering, those two. I know those are two controversial areas. Management would be a third. Three areas of focus still up in the air. Anything you'd want to add, Susan?
That's really a very big question surrounding strategic pathways is which campuses or universities actually would be designated as lead universities in particular areas, what would the scope of that responsibility be, and what does it actually mean to be a lead university in any of these areas? And all of those questions, in fact, are unresolved, although they've been discussed in a preliminary way. There's a span of possibilities ranging from the UAA nursing model, which you're familiar with, I believe, where essentially one institution controls everything about the program, employs all of the faculty or nearly all of the faculty, collects all of the tuition revenue, enrolls all of the students, and so forth. But there are also many other possibilities, including that it would be essentially a collaborative situation where two or three universities would continue to offer the program and would continue to maintain their accreditation, but there would be increased efforts to share resources across the universities and to share instruction, to share other costs. So, like I say, there's that spectrum. Where it lands remains to be seen.
Thank you, Provost Hendricks. Is that your comment, or you wanted to comment more?
I was going to
comment. Okay, so on to your comment.
I'll be brief since this comment period has been extending quite some time. Strategic pathways has been, as Mike Powers here has said, consuming pretty much all of the time of leadership for the past couple of weeks. And I do want to first apologize if any of you have been waiting for me to do something or wanting me to attend a meeting with you or something of that sort, because I've had to cancel a lot of things and I haven't gotten to everything I should have done. Strategic pathways, in my mind, has potential to be a good thing for the University of Alaska system, but the challenge for each university is to work during the strategic pathways development process, design process, to, first of all, of course, preserve its identity as a university, but secondly, to make sure that it retains as much revenue-generating potential as possible, because our future as a university system, and particularly as a University of Alaska Fairbanks, will depend on our ability to generate both tuition and research revenue and other forms of revenue as we can. The state, in any future that I can readily imagine, is not going to be providing as much of our revenue as it has in the past. If we want to maintain our activities, our scope, our service to students, our research productivity, and our outreach efforts in much the same level of effort that we have now, more revenue generation is the way that we can do that. The responsibility for different academic programs within the system was rearranged so that many of our largest enrollment programs were only offered at other institutions and not by us any longer. That obviously isn't a desirable outcome from the standpoint of our future. So I've certainly been paying attention to that, as has the entire administrative team here at UAF. That's one of our big goals here, is to make sure that UAF retains the ability to help itself through generation of revenue.
Thank you, Provost Hendricks. Vice Chancellor Hinsman, please, your comments.
Thanks. I only have a few things that I want to touch on. So one thing is John Walsh is the chief scientist at the International Arctic Research Center. He just received the International Arctic Science Committee's Arctic Medal this year, so it's the highest honor in Arctic science, and so we're real proud of him. And I think it's that award is good for the whole university. We really want to promote those activities. And so if you see of opportunities for awards or prizes for individuals or units, please, you know, bring them to our attention, and we'll promote them. We'll go after those things. And so I'll be glad to lead on those if you bring them to my attention. I don't see everything, but we really try and do that as much as we can. The other thing is we really want to place our people on the committees that are defining the future of science. And so if you see those opportunities where we need to nominate people to serve on those national or international committees, please bring those to our attention too. And we can try and get the UAF faculty positioned on those for those opportunities. The other thing I wanted to mention is just about the ASSW. That's the Arctic Science Summit Week and AOS. The planning for that's going very, very well. And I hope that you'll all engage in that. We've got a tremendous number of people coming. We're having at least 7 of the 8 senior Arctic officials will be coming. We've got several ambassadors, several cabinet-level ministers are coming up. It's going to be a big meeting. We've also got a tremendous number of program managers, program directors from National Science Foundation, NASA, NOAA, Department of Energy, NPRB. So all of the major funding agencies that are important to us. And so I really encourage you all to establish those personal relationships or maintain the personal relationships that you need with program managers to get projects funded. And so, you know, in the time that you have, in the 6 weeks you have, you know, shoot notes to your program managers and encourage your colleagues to do the same. Ask if the program managers are coming up, and if they are, you know, try and set up a time to meet with them and take advantage of it. You know, and ask them what the opportunities are that are coming up. If you have an idea that's brewing, you know, ask them if it's appropriate for a certain program. If it's not, ask them if you have an idea you want to take someplace, ask where you could take it. You know, try and establish that personal relationship and really, you know, ferret out the ways that we can get these projects funded. It's a really, you're never going to have a better opportunity to meet with all these program managers at one place at one time without paying any travel money. And again, there's just a tremendous number of people coming up who are the decision makers and the policy makers for international Arctic science. And so it's a good opportunity to interact with them and have an influence on Arctic science. So I encourage you to participate and come to the sessions, come to the receptions and the banquets, and really put on a good show for UAF. And that's all I've got. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Hinsman. Okay, now I'm going to open this for next 5-6 minutes for public comment and member comment in the interest of time. So please go ahead. Member comment is fine. Public comments are fine. Yes, go ahead. Donnie.
I have a question for Susan, which is, has it been considered how the strategic pathways is likely to affect accreditation? Because presumably you can't be a university if you only offer science and technology or only liberal arts.
Accreditation is definitely an issue that's being considered, both institutional accreditation and specialized accreditation of several of our programs. Part of strategic pathways is a statement down toward the bottom of the page that general education, the humanities, the arts will continue to be offered at all universities, and so there would be sufficient offerings of those under any envisioned plan to maintain our institutional accreditation. But there are more difficulties with some of our specialized accreditations, depending on exactly how this is implemented.
Any other comments, questions? Anybody in Zoom? Looks like we have clarified everything to everybody. Okay, so with that, we'll move on to governance reports. Faye from Staff Council.
Okay, thank you. So right now, next door, actually, we're having the orientation for our new staff council members. And we've managed to fill almost all of our seats. Normally, we tend to have several vacant positions as people have trouble finding time, as I'm sure you all understand. But we actually have, I believe, record high filling of our seats after our last election. So we're orienting our new members now. A couple announcements, if you haven't heard them in other places. There are a few awards that are open for nominations right now. The Chancellor's Cornerstone Award, which is due by February 26th for people who make outstanding contributions to the university and the community. There's also the Staff Make Students Count Award, which is at the university system level and is awarded to one staff member from each university. And it's a pretty big deal. And I would really urge you to consider if there are staff in your units or your areas who are really helping make an impact to your students, to consider getting an application or a nomination in for them. It takes a little bit of work. You need some letters from students. But if you have someone great in mind, please nominate them. And that's due this Friday. And then we're looking at the proposed telecommuting policy that's or regulation at the system level. Looking at some of the new performance evaluation templates from HR for our staff performance evaluations. And then also at the system level, we passed at Staff Alliance a resolution in support of the public safety regulations, which you may have seen the proposed regulations that sort of set out how our campus police operate, which my understanding is that it doesn't change anything that we're currently doing. It just puts a regulation in place to match what we're currently doing. Does anyone have any questions? Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Faye. Yeah. Leslie from ASUF.
On behalf of UAF student body, we again want to thank you for including us in your meetings. This meeting, we have several items to report on. One is legislative advocacy. The Juno Legislative Affairs Advocacy Conference will be held from the 27th of February to March 1st, and 41 students from across the state, 8 from UAF, will be advocating for the university to legislators. We are highly excited for this trip, both for the educational opportunities we will have and for the chance to argue for the university. We are currently training to be effective advocates and developing a common message for all students to argue. 2, student grade appeals. We are highly excited to tell you that we will be coordinating with you, the Faculty Senate, to work on reforming the grade appeals process and making it more accessible, transparent, and fair. We would like to express our sincere thanks to you, the Faculty Senate, for being so open to our involvement in this project. 3, the Board of Regents meeting. As you probably know, the Board of Regents will be meeting here in Fairbanks on the 18th and 19th of this month. We are encouraging students to testify at the board and hope to again bring the same quality of student testimony that has made us such an impact in the past. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Leslie? All right. Thank you, Leslie. Let's go to UNAC. Chris Kaufman, please.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay, good. So United Academics has been very busy lately. We are preparing for our next contract negotiations, which will begin in fall of 2016. Our current contract expires in December of 2016. We're also watching with great concern as Strategic Pathways unfolds, and we'll be ensuring that any plans that are put forth are in compliance with the collective bargaining agreement, Board of Regents policy, and university policies. Do let us know if there is any communication about strategic pathways that you would like to call to our attention. Finally, I have for you a petition. We, in collaboration with UAFT, are circulating a petition that is reaffirming our commitment to strong shared governance in the process of developing strategic pathways. It reads, "We, the undersigned faculty at the University of Alaska, call for our president and board of regents to ensure that UA faculty members, through shared governance, are central to decision-making regarding the future structure of the university. As faculty, we provide our students with a high-quality education, and our input will be invaluable to any future decision-making about how to further the university's mission of advancing and disseminating knowledge through teaching, research, and public service, emphasizing the North and its diverse people. So I'm going to send this around. If anyone would like to sign on to restate our commitment to shared governance. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for Chris? Okay. Jane, UAFT.
Thanks, Chris, for sending that around. I've also put petitions at the back of the room if anyone wants to sign. And, yeah, so that'd be awesome. And the other thing I wanted to report on was that the Joint Healthcare Committee will be meeting on February 25th to work on setting the rates, the healthcare rates for FY17.
Higher or lower?
What's that?
Higher or lower?
What do you think?
Any questions for Jane? All right. Is Katie here already?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. Katie, come here now.
Hi. So I don't have a great deal to report today. Just a few things. On January 28th, there was a member engagement meeting at the APEA office, and we're just continuing to brainstorm ways to involve adjunct faculty and reach out to people, members, and all of that. One thing that I just wanted to mention is I've noticed some issues with follow-through. For example, in the fall, I received an email from an adjunct in business who was underpaid based on her course having low enrollment, but then the course reached full enrollment, and she emailed me to see if she could receive that pay. So I brought that to the attention of different people, and I thought that, you know, definitely most people agreed that that should be taken care of, but I recently reached out to her and it still was an issue for her. So a little bit of issue with follow through with situations such as that, which I thought I'd mention. And then the final thing I wanted to mention is just a suggestion that I had brainstormed with a couple other adjunct faculty members, perhaps that in the fall, people who are rehired for adjunct positions could potentially, some of that might be based on some sort of seniority. Just a suggestion, though. And thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Any questions for Katie? All right. Thank you, Chris, Jane, and Katie for your reports. Let's move on to athletics. Danny?
Hi, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm Danny Shepherd. I am the faculty athletics representative here at UAF. I am a faculty member in the psychology department and serve as a liaison between athletics and academics. A few things that have happened since I was here last time. One thing that's very exciting to report is that the student athletes have worked together on their own to take the lead on the Green Dot program on campus and have made a commitment that all 130 of them will be trained in the Green Dot initiative. So they are working toward that. A couple of them have expressed interest in becoming Green Dot trainers as well. So very exciting that they have taken the leadership on that and making that commitment. One other exciting thing that's happening is we have a couple of student athletes who are working toward qualifying for the Olympics. So you might see some of our UAF athletes represented at the Summer Olympics this year. So they're working hard toward that. In what I have done since I was here last, the NCAA annual convention occurred in January. That is where we vote on all of the legislative items that go forth into the big rules book, and the FARs, the faculty athletic reps from all the institutions, have a pretty strong voice in that. One of the things that we worked hard toward this year is a couple of the legislative items
We're intending to extend seasons a little bit longer, and so a lot of the voice helped keep those legislative items from being passed. So right now, seasons will stay at the current length that they are to decrease or to not increase travel time and time away from classes. So that was a very exciting thing that happened in January. One of the duties that I have is the chair of the Athletic Advisory Board that serves as an advisory board to the Chancellor and Vice Chancellor Sraga. And we've been working very hard with the budget situation, helping to generate some innovative ideas for revenue generation and cutting costs. So they're working hard on that as well. They also have a NCAA provides financial consulting in terms of some ideas of how to get budgets trimmed down. So they're working hard with that. And then the final report, as some of you may have heard in the news, the final ruling for the NCAA investigation, the appeal that was submitted last year, has come through. The final decision has come through. So a 5 or 6 year process of investigation and sanctions and appeals and decisions there is finally done. So we shouldn't hear any more of the investigation process. So all penalties and sanctions are in place. And if you have any questions on that, I'd be happy to answer those. Debu and Jane both know how to contact me. Any questions that I can answer for anybody? Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Danny. That was a wonderful report. Before we move into our inviting our guest speaker, Mike Castellini, and we have a very important discussion today, I would like to really bring to your note, and this was passed on to me by Joy Morrison, Faculty Development Office, and I forgot to mention that in my report. There is going to be a seminar on February 23, 12:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. in Rasmussen 340 and 3 to 5 in Murray Auditorium. And it's about responding to toxic behavior in departments and next steps to that. This is going to be led by Libby Roderick of UAA. If you have an interest in this and if you believe that there are toxic behaviors in your department, this is something you should encourage yourself or your faculty to go and attend. With that, I would like to invite Associate Dean of Graduate School, Mike Castellini, Laura Bender, B.J. Eldridge. The topic today is graduate student insurance rates. Thank you for being here.
There we go. Much better. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I wanted to introduce Laura Bender, who's the director of our graduate programs, and Dr. B.J. Eldridge, who runs the Health and Counseling Center. This is an informational section for you. You can probably read articles in the Chronicle Higher Education, in newspapers, NPR, et cetera, on issues about graduate student health insurance across the country, relative, especially now, in light of changes that have come from the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, last May when we were negotiating, or 2 Mays ago, I guess, when we were negotiating the current contract, we spent most of our quality time with the lawyers trying to figure out the interpretations of the ACA relative to employment, IRS rules, et cetera, and the meetings that we go to with other graduate schools across the country, this topic takes a considerable amount of time as we're trying to figure out how these interact with one another. Clearly, a lot of that depends on the upcoming election, too, and any changes that might come in on the federal level with the ACA, so it's a moving field around us. The data that we're presented to you on the website is mainly informational demographics, letting you know the costs, how it's distributed over the time. And so I wanted to go through the history of this a little bit not spend a lot of time with us talking, but to be able to answer questions for you. There's no motion on the table. There's no actions that are being asked for you to take, but it's a history and to try to also give you some background as you are asked questions by your graduate students or by others, staff and faculty, as to how we handle insurance. This is, and Dr. Aldrich can cover this for you in detail if you have questions. This is not the same issue as a graduate student here on campus. I've got a sore throat today. I don't feel well. I want to go to the health center and get, you know, some medicine, antibiotics. That's a different topic. That is the issue of the fees that the students pay in order to get their health care on a daily basis. I need to go to the health center today. We do have an issue that statewide needs to consider in terms of how we have students that may not necessarily be on their home campus. So we have about 50 graduate students or so that are not here in Fairbanks. And where do they go for their health if they're in Juneau or Kodiak or Seward or Boston or wherever they happen to be? We do have that issue to resolve and solve for some of our students. For instance, there are 25 to 30 that are in Juneau in the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. But that's not an insurance topic as we're here today. That's amongst the individual health centers to try to resolve, probably at the vice chancellor level. And so I want to reemphasize to you, if you're one of your graduate students today comes to you and says, I'm sick, I'm not feeling well, they go to the health center, they're taken care of, they can get inexpensive vaccinations, a whole variety of different help. And I'll have BJ help with this if you have questions. Separate topic, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is that roughly we have about 1,200 plus or minus graduate students at any given time. And through a program, the history of which was sitting to my right, the provost, when she was the dean of the graduate school, started the process of saying, let's make available to our RAs and our TAs health insurance programs that we pay for. So run through the university administration, central costs, our health insurance, the costs for those programs that we negotiate. So we have about 1,200 students. About 400 plus or minus, somewhere between 425 and 450 at any given moment, are on RAs and TAs at about a half and half each, about 50% half TA and 50% RA that have their health insurance currently paid for them by the university. That means we have somewhere between at any given moment, also on campus, 600 to 700 graduate students that are not covered through this program. They're either covered through their parents if they're young, although on the average our students are probably above that 26-year-old cutoff. They either have something on the ACA now or some other policy as that's required on, as you all know, as you're filling out your IRS tax forms, they're starting to ask now about health insurance as part of the ACA compliance. So what we're talking about here is the 4 to 450 at any given moment that are covered by our policies that we pay for the RAs and the TAs. The teaching assistants get paid. We process that paperwork here through the graduate program, and it comes out of central funds. For those of you that write grants proposals that have students on them, you'll recognize there's a line on your grant proposals and your cost accounting if you have an RA working for you that we're covering health insurance. Of course, we all know, and you were talking about having your own our own discussions on our own health policies over the last years, the divergence between what we can pay for roughly $1 million a year ballpark versus what we get for that, of course, is diverging. We know that ourselves from our own health care coverage, from our own plans. That becomes harder and harder to fulfill and get some decent coverage. So when we negotiated this last year, we had the choice between, you know, the really optimum golden plan, which would be extremely expensive, the sort of the middle of the road plan, which is the one we choose and chose, and then the one that didn't do anything, really had very high deductibles, really didn't help the students a lot. So we in fact talked to a lot of the graduate students, and they said, we simply can't afford the inexpensive one because we can't afford the deductibles, and the university can't afford the platinum one. So we went for a one in the middle. we can go over with you if you have questions, which will open up for us as to what that actually covers at any given moment. But, of course, every year that we negotiate it, for roughly the fixed amount of money we have, the amount of coverage we can get continues to decline. So now the issue that we're coming up with and is being faced by universities across the nation, which is what you can read about either in our peer institutions, Montana, Idaho, or Laura handed me an article today from Pennsylvania State. Many universities now are saying, we can't afford this anymore. And now that ACA is in place, the students have the option to be able to get insurance either through their parents, once again, if they're young enough, not applicable to all graduate students, or through the marketplace, through ACA, in order to be able to cover themselves. For the 600 students plus on campus now that are not covered by our own insurance program, I actually don't know what they do, and we can't go about asking all the students, what are you doing for health insurance? That's IRS can ask that. I can't ask that. So I don't know, actually, what the other 600 to 700 students are doing at any one given moment. The concern, of course, relates to our 400 to 500 that are working either as RAs or TAs. So we've had lots of discussions amongst universities, amongst graduate deans, provosts across the country. How are you handling this? And a great number of them have said, we simply can't afford this anymore. Some of them have taken some of the money that they've supported the students with and increased the stipends a little bit in an effort to try to help the cost of students to buy insurance. I was reading statements from Montana today, University of Montana. That's what they're doing. But we were told, a whole group of us, in not too words that were being caged too much, that if we were to say, we're going to pay for your health insurance sort of as a competition to, or we're going to take the stipend and you have to use that to do your health insurance, that you could all send us, you know, our best wishes when we're in jail from the IRS, because we can't do that. We're not allowed to actually do that. So we can sort of say, well, your stipends have going up a little bit, and if you wanted to spend this on health insurance, you could. But we can't actually make that switch, because then we'd be seen as competing with the market and a whole variety of other IRS concerns. So what we're faced with now, as we look at our budget considerations, is ballpark somewhere between $750,000 and $1 million a year that is being spent by the university in health insurance. And admittedly, half of that's coming from research grants, research proposals, the other half straight out of central administration costs. And what we can afford to buy, and the increasing costs of trying to support that over time, and keeping ourselves legal with the ACA. We spend a lot of time with the lawyers making sure that's true. And some of the questions we've had is, can't we just consider them employees? Well, no, we can't, because RAs and TAs sit in their own individual type of tax status, how many hours they can work, so they're not true employees, so we can't roll them into Premera or Blue Cross. And likewise, we can't offer something to them that's cheaper that would be seen as competing as an employee with Blue Cross or Premera, so we can't do that either. So we're in this pathway that we have to follow, but we are faced with this issue that it keeps costs keep going up, what we can provide keeps going down, and the ability to support those 400 students. That's the information we're at. The data that you have there, or you can, I don't know, it's not on the screen, but it is available on your computers, is just simply information on the costs, how many students per quarter we spend, what the cost per program is, and it's about $1,500 now. A semester? Sorry, here we go.
For spring-summer, and we only do spring-summer, we do fall, and then we do spring-summer, and the entire, for the entire year is $2,361, so $2,361 per graduate student.
Make sure you're speaking here so they can hear you better.
Okay, sorry, so I don't think I have more information to try to present, but the provost knows this program very well since we work closely with her, and she was the one who came up with the original plan. And, of course, BJ sees student health insurance issues and students on a daily basis, and we work it from the administrative graduate student side. So we're available to answer questions and or concerns. There have been lots of people asking, what are the 400 going to do? It's going to have to be a solution like the other 600 are facing at the moment if this program goes away. In our current plans for FY17, there was some discussion at the beginning of whether or not that would be considered as a potential reduction. The provost let us know last month that at least for FY17, at the moment, unless it gets a lot worse, we're going to continue to support this. That's our status at the moment, and I'll ask if Laura or BJ want to say anything. Laura?
Do you want to give BJ to give an overview of the current policy as it stands with the high deductible?
The question is whether I want a description of what the actual plan is, or whether which BJ can answer, or if you want other topics. So I'll open it up for questions.
That would be helpful.
Okay, Rainer.
I think the real question is, what are you planning on doing? Obviously, nothing is not a solution.
The answer is for FY17, the decision was to continue to support them. For FY17, we will provide that support, according to the provost. For FY18, by that time, we may have new ACA regulations coming in. And the question is, can we make that, will we be able to afford it in FY18 will probably be the question. It looks like Susan's going to make a comment here.
Yeah, that's essentially the answer that I was going to give, that there'll be an election, a lot of things will change, and I think the real decision year is for FY18.
Okay, yeah.
Can I just see if I've got the math right on this? It comes out about $1 million a year to insure all the grad students that are insured. Call it $1 million. Half of that is coming from research grants, so the cost of the university is about $500,000.
Right.
But if you stop doing this, so we stop putting the graduate health insurance on our research grants, that's also another 50% of overhead that's not coming in. So that's another $250,000. So the net saving by cutting this would actually only be $250,000?
My guess is that if a research person has those funds left over, they're going to reprogram, not left over, but they would reprogram that into their costs. I don't know if that into research costs or stipends or something along those lines. I don't know the impact on... if we modeled it, if it was $500,000 that was simply not spent in Fund 2, yes, then there would be the loss of that Fund 1, the ICR. It could be fairly complex modeling, but it depends on whether or not then you would say, okay, I'm not spending the health insurance, so I'm going to spend it on, reagents or something else instead. Very hard to predict that part.
Yeah, Franz and then Jane.
Maybe you go first.
Okay, Jane, you get first and then Franz.
We've talked about this in the Joint Healthcare Committee, and it made perfect sense to many of us that the grad students be part of our pool and also the undergraduate students if possible, because it just increases our pool. But that hasn't seemed to be able to happen. Do you have any insight on that?
This fall 2015, we did away with the undergraduate student insurance plan, and that's because the insurance company would no longer insure undergraduates unless we went to a fully hard waivered system. We used to have kind of a quasi waiver system where we told students that they had to have insurance, but it was never enforced, and it was never automatically, 15, 20 years ago it was, but it wasn't automatically put on their bill. And so the insurance company does not see that as a hard waiver. The only hard waiver we have right now is for international students on the different visas. So if we wanted to have a bigger pool, the university system would have to be willing to go to a hard waiver system where all students taking a certain number of credits had it automatically added to their bill, and the only way they could have it taken off their bill is to show whatever office decided to participate in it the proof of equivalent insurance. And I just wanted to say one other thing, too, about this price of the current premium for this insurance policy is based upon how we decided to do the deductible and the coinsurance. So there's always wiggle room from year to year in terms of how much premium you all want to pay versus what you want to offer your students. If you want to offer your students a really nice plan, then you make the deductible low and the coinsurance low as well. But if you want to offer them a catastrophic plan where their deductible is going to be much higher, then certainly the premium of that goes down. So it's always that kind of weighing out the options there.
I wanted to address one last issue. Was my the lawyers let us know that we could not, and I'll defer to the provost if she has a better way of explaining this. We could not put the students into the regular employee pool because they're not employees.
Franz, you had a question?
And it's a little bit of a detracting question, so I'm asking it anyway for now. So currently for grad students, for U.S. grad students, it is not required to be part of the UAF healthcare pool, as far as I remember.
That's correct, because we've got 600 plus that are not.
Yes. So my question is, I have one case of a grad student that is of higher age and has opted to get an insurance plan that covers things that he requires to be covered. And so he is technically on my research grant, so I'm paying $1,000 to the university for healthcare that is not being covered, that is not being used. And so I was wondering if I instead can take these $1,000 and substitute his plan that he has decided to pick instead. It's not going to cover everything, but can I? Because I still want to, you know, support my students' healthcare costs. So currently I'm paying into a pool, that, and it's not getting used for the purpose that it's supposed to be used.
The agreement that we currently have with UnitedHealthcare is a no opt-out plan. So any student who is on a research assistantship, teaching assistantship, and many of our fellowships, they are required to take part in the UnitedHealthcare plan. That's to keep, obviously, to keep the pool bigger, which keeps costs down. So in your case, that you would not be able to have the student opt out and then pay the student for coverage that he would then gain on his own.
Okay.
Great. And our current coverage does not include dental, and it does not include vision, which a lot of our students do ask about.
Okay.
We could have it cover vision and dental, but it would be very high priced, and reality is most preventive dental and eye visits aren't near as expensive as if we were to include them in the premium.
Okay, any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mike, Laura, and
thank you very much.
Yeah, let's give them a big hand, please. Okay, we have a 7 minutes break now. We'll be back at 2:10. Thank you.
So we start again at 3:30.
We'll begin with our second half of the meeting. And we are into new business now. The first one is the resolution supporting gender-inclusive language that is submitted by Status of Women. I would request Jane to first introduce that, and then we'll have a motion to adopt it.
The resolution just basically recommends that UAF begin using the gender-inclusive term first year instead of freshman. It's becoming common practice across the U.S., and we think we should be with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Now I entertain a motion to adopt this resolution, please.
So moved.
Any seconds?
Second.
Thank you. Now it's open for discussion. Any discussions? Yeah.
I didn't like the term first year when I first heard it, and the more I hear it, the more I like it, actually. I find it reminiscent of Harry Potter, for example. I've certainly seen a lot of times in computer science when changing the computer language, it actually changes the way you think about problems. So I do feel like this is not a fluff issue, right? There's an ongoing debate on language shaping thought.
Can we change the grade system now to exceeds expectation and all that?
Sorry?
Yes, right.
Any other comments?
I would add from the registrar's office that there would still be, there's still a class standing called freshman. So freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, as it's defined in the catalog, and I believe by Board of Regents is up to 30 credits.
So what does that mean? That this is a resolution, but anyway. But
I believe when we're referring to students in text, we can use first year, but the class standing would remain as freshmen.
Okay.
Can we change that?
I believe that that's set by Board of Regents, but I can check on it.
If it is in board policy or university regulation, it is possible to change it. It would require someone to bring forward a proposal to do that. I'll look into where it is. And once we find out where it is, then we can find out what the process is to change it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Provost.
But basically, UAF can't unilaterally change university regulations. It has to be all three schools in concert.
True. Thank you. Well, we can take a proposal for the alliance to debate on it. You know, so that should be possible. Okay. Any other comments, questions, thoughts? Hearing none, any objections to adopting this resolution as is? All right, thank you. The resolution is adopted. Next item is a motion to approve a new MA in Marine Science, and this was submitted by GAC. Donnie, I'll request you to introduce it, and then we'll entertain the motion.
Okay, and I would actually, so this came through the Graduate Academic Advisory Committee, and it seems like a good idea, but I would actually like to invite Brad, who is the Dean of the School of Fisheries and Ocean Science, to come and introduce this and give a little background on it. Any microphone will do. He'll be quick.
Good afternoon, everyone. My microphone on. It's great to be here. I've been here a month, so this will be a month and a day for me. None of you I know, but some of you I do. Yes, I'm happy to introduce this degree. There are flyers. I believe you received them, if I'm not mistaken. And we have a lot more flyers put together. I want to acknowledge first Brenda Konar and her team who put this program together. And in coming here was one of the reasons that I was quite attracted to this position, because even though the word new is used in here, and I understand the sensitivity around that, it's actually a creative a realignment, if you like, or alignment of existing courses, no new faculty. The new part is the new revenue stream and the ability to be competitive with other institutions that are going after students that SFOS have. And those students are after different career paths. They're after more professional master's career paths as opposed to pure research. So there's a large cadre of those students out there, and they are willing to pay tuition. I've seen this where I just came from 40, 50, 60 students. Master's tuition paying students is quite reasonable per year. So I just wanted to give a really, you know, a top sort of few talking points on that, and I think entertain discussion, because I know you're all very busy and want to keep moving along. But I just want to emphasize there's not a new ask here in terms of resources, funds or the like. It really is addressing a need and doing it with what we have already on the books in terms of resources. I'd also just want to say one other point. It's really quite a key piece of SFOS as it's looking to restructure itself that Interim Dean Joan Braddock has put out and we're moving ahead on in terms of expanding the graduate program, but also undergraduate programs, which are, in fact, vitally linked to research at this University of Alaska Fairbanks. So I'm happy to entertain any questions, and I know Brenda's here, and she can provide you more. Is that capturing it, Brenda? Yes? So I'd like to get to the point, and you know, you want to ask questions, whatever. And thank you for your attention and consideration.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me entertain a motion at this point to accept, to approve the new MA in Marine Science.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Now we are open for discussion and questions, comments. And Brenda is here, so Brenda can also answer questions.
So my question is this is an entirely course-based master's? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, it would be non-thesis-based master's degree. That's right.
So it would be all course-based?
That's correct, yeah.
And how would this interact with Juno? I understand there. Don't they have a...
Well, Juno has a campus that's part of, if I understand correctly, that's part of SFOS, okay. The Lena Point facility. So all of that capacity that we already have in place would be part
utilized.
Of this.
Utilized.
Correct.
Okay, and so we are expecting this to be a two-year master's?
Yeah. I mean, the other benefit of this is that unlike when, for those folks that have master's students that do research, it often takes longer. It can take 3 years. And I think that graduation timing is important, you know, having folks get their degree on time. So this is actually possible. It doesn't rely on student research success, et cetera, in that regard.
Other comments, questions? All right. Thank you. Now to the voting. Any objections to approving the new MA in Marine Science? Hearing none, it's approved. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. The third one is motion to approve a unit criteria for the Cross-Cultural Studies Department, and I will request Mara... Okay, to introduce it.
Is it on? Yes. Okay. The Mara unit, chair of the unit criteria committee, and Center for Cross-Cultural Studies unit criteria first draft was extremely well done, required very little changes or suggestions, and so recommend that it be approved, and we'll take any questions when you open it for discussion.
Okay. Let me entertain a motion to approve this.
Second.
Thank you. Any comments, questions for Mara or anybody else? Please ask now or hold your peace forever. Okay. all right. Any objections to approving the unit criteria? Hearing none, it's approved. Next one is again, this is by CAC. I'm sorry, Jenny. Motion to approve a new minor in art history.
Yeah, so this is a, is this on? Do I need this on?
It's on.
It's on, okay. This is a new minor in art history. The courses are all already taught. So it would be just allowing students to officially package their minor as an art history minor.
Okay. Entertaining a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussions, questions, comments? Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Zoe Jones. I teach all of the art history courses. I just had one comment on the proposal as it stands. The note at the bottom of the first page, the original wording on that was that the minor in art history It was to be published in the course catalog, as the minor in art history is currently only available to non-art majors. I don't know how the wording got changed. So you couldn't take the minor as an art major.
Okay. So we can, somebody can propose an amendment, minor amendment.
So moved. Strike that language.
Okay, so the language is, and this is an amendment, the language is a minor in art history is currently available only for non-art majors. Is that what
correct.
It is? Okay. So an addition of only, and we have a motion. Reiner has offered a motion of amendment. Any second?
Second.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? None. Any objections to the amendment? None. Okay. So now we pass the amendment. Now back to our discussion on the original motion. Anything else?
No.
No. Okay. No comments. Then let's find out if there are any objections to approving the motion for a new minor in art history. I see none. It's approved. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so Jenny, again, new minor in computer information technology specialist.
Yeah, so again, this is another new minor in CITS. It would be housed down at CTC. And this minor, as they say in here, it's going to, it's a minor that really supports workforce development and work skills. That can add that kind of aspect to a student's bachelor's degree.
Okay, thank you for the information. I need to entertain a motion now. Oh, okay. Anybody seconds?
Second.
Yeah, thank you. Any comments, questions? None. Any objections? None. The minor in computer information technology specialist is approved. Thank you all. 2:25. We are 10 minutes ahead of time, so good. Next, I hope we can use the 10 minutes on this one.
No. We don't.
This is an information item, GER's course classification guidelines and list submitted by SCAC. And who would like to introduce this one, Reiner or Jenny, yeah. Okay.
I knew there was a reason they suckered me into this position this year. So as everybody knows, we have been working in CAC on implementing this new set of guidelines for classification system to replace the PHCs. And so we have completed our work. The committee has come up with these guidelines that you see here that they've approved, and based on these guidelines, we have selected classes that will meet, starting in the fall, the new classification system. Things to keep in mind, only students entering in for the next catalog year would be eligible for this unless they changed catalog years. So there's a significant number of students, majority of students, who would still be under the PHC for next year. All of the PHC courses are contained in the list. They are still there, so this is an expansion. And the idea here is that as we see how this goes, as more people come under more students come under this system, departments will be able to add to the list to give a nice range of options for students in these areas. And I think probably that's all I need to say, and we'll just start taking questions if people have questions.
Thank you, Jenny. I have a question, really. I just heard a comment that you mentioned that the guidelines have been approved by them. Who are they?
Oh, the committee, excuse
me. Oh,
the committee.
All right, so, yeah, you have the list, and any questions for CAC? Yeah, go ahead, Jamie.
So this, at the current time, is there still voting that has to happen before this does go into place for the fall, or this is going into place in the fall? Let me tell you why I'm asking. I'm asking because, obviously, if this goes into effect, I know, yes, it's only for the current freshmen, but some people will change catalog years because they like to do that, which means the enrollment in these classes is then going to be very different, maybe. Like, if a class hasn't been a GER class and it maybe is set for an enrollment of 20 and it becomes on this list, it may have much more interest, which affects room scheduling and class sizes. And so are they going to know in order to maybe shuffle around with scheduling, and is scheduling going to be open to that kind of change being made now at this stage of the game?
I think that there's going to be a lot of consideration that's going to have to go in for a department who says, okay, this is on the list. Do we need another section, or do we need a larger section? There's a few classes on here, well, only one that I can really think of, that is absolutely needs to think about that, because they already know that they have large demand, and that's probably psych, right? For the others, my feeling is that we shouldn't be jumping through a whole bunch of hoops to change, you know, how we offer our sections or how large they are, until we get an idea of where the demand is going to be and where it's going to go. So I personally wouldn't recommend people make big changes. You know, if there's a whole bunch of students, I know that nobody wants to give up students and revenue, but there's, you know, if you have a class that's scheduled for 20 students and you've got another, you know, 5 students who want to take it and you can't accommodate them, you know, for that semester they can select something else. You know, the idea is to get into this as smoothly as we can, and without a huge amount of disruption, even though there will be some.
Right. Well, I mean, because if it's set at 20 and maybe there were 50 students that wanted to take it, we don't necessarily know that there were those 30 other students who went and saw that it was full. So how would we gauge that interest was there otherwise?
Oh, I would guess, first of all, that your wait list would go off.
But those are usually capped at 5 to 10, right, before they register to let more people on.
I mean, I would think that we would have the advisors would be paying attention to that, you know, and that sort of thing, yeah.
Okay. In fact, what is the plan at this point? I don't know, to disseminate this to the students in a clear way. Has your committee thought about that, or should we discuss this in some forum?
Well, the Sunstar is the obvious route.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
The Sunstar is an obvious route.
I know, and you and I have been contacted by this fellow.
Mm-hmm. So presumably it'll show up there.
I'm sorry?
Presumably it's going to show up there.
Okay. So we have to kind of slowly disseminate this to the students so that they know about this beforehand. That's all my comment is. Anything else to add, or anything else concerning?
I think we'd have to think about the advisors better. Yeah, no, the advisors do know.
Okay. Well, if there is no other discussion, then I'm guessing that this is acceptable to all, and we should. The committee should move forward with the next step. Okay, we are into public comments. Any public comment at this point? All right, no public comment. Let me get into member comments, questions. Any general comments or announcements by members? All right. Today is a quiet meeting. All right. Let me go around the committee chairs with one thing that they're working on. Let's start with curricular affairs, so we know what you're working on, but...
Oh, obviously, we've been working on the GERs, and the next thing that we're working on is the grade appeals policy.
Thank you. Chris Fallon is not here today, so unit criteria, Mara.
I have formed a small subgroup, and we have a revision of the Blue Book underway. I've started a rough draft and particularly paying close attention to some of the issues that have been raised, joint primacy, the big bugaboo, which is the promotion, a codified promotion process for non-tenure track faculty. And so I have a draft completed, and we are wordsmithing it. And so this will be coming your way in parts or pieces. I'm not sure yet. So it's underway.
So Mara, you had some questions about the special status and other stuff. Would you like to raise that now?
Yeah, I mean, I'll raise this as a trial balloon, and everybody can just shoot it or go screaming out into the halls or whatever is going to be needed. But we have, at least at UAF, we have roughly about 41% to 47% non-tenure track faculty. And to classify these as a special rank seems a little bit dated, because when you have almost half of your faculty as non-tenure track, I'm not sure that they're special. I mean, we're all special in our own way, but I wouldn't necessarily. So my first, in some informal discussions, is that clearly we need to have some redefining or new definitions. And I've had various conversations throughout the last few years with Provost, the union, Debu within Faculty Senate, and just different venues or different people, that we really need to have some new definitions. And one that has come sort of floating up is that we would classify, we already have research faculty, that we would have service and teaching faculty that would be able to address the fact that then the rural campuses and then the CTC, we have a lot of non-tenure track faculty whose primary function is teaching. So a larger percentage of their workload is teaching. I work for extension. The great percentage of my workload is service, so I would feel comfortable being looked at as a service faculty. And then, of course, in the research institutes, we have the research faculty. How the rest of the Blue Book gets revised in terms of termination, promotion, evaluation really rests on how you define these groups or whether we need to redefine them. So that has to be sort of the first issue. But I have written through the whole thing, the ideal. I have not in my wildest dreams do I hope that this will actually take that form. But anyway, I just sat down one weekend and did it because for my own edification. And we have a working group, and we're just sitting. I know that the finished project is not going to necessarily look like this, but we needed something to start with. And we took what past revisions had been and included those and expanded them. And there's quite a few sections, like the IAS needs to be addressed. There's small things, there's big things. So,
thank you.
Yes.
Jane, anything on comic? Oh, sorry. Didn't look on this.
Just a quick piece of information. Faculty classifications are in university regulation, Board of Regents policy, and so if you want to change any of those, you have to go to that point to change it.
And that is understood, but I thought rather than getting bogged down in all of the process of, you know, is find what is a good way to go, and then we'll pick at the pieces and, you know, do what we need to do if it looks like this is a good approach, because otherwise to use something that exists just to avoid going to the BOR doesn't seem to really solve the problem. So I realize that. And I've marked where we would need to either have either at the BOR level, other university policies, places where I have questions or where it rests, and then with the union as well. So, yeah. It's a long process. I have no illusions about that. Maybe 200.
Any questions for Mara, by the way? I mean, because she has brought up this one, so... All right. Jane, do you have, your comment, please, about status of women?
Committee on the Status of Women is working on preparing for our promotion and tenure workshop, the yearly workshop in April, and various conversation cafes.
Thank you. Andy is here, co-review. Okay. You wanted to make a quick comment on?
No new updates, just working on petitions.
Petitions, okay, thank you. Curriculum review, Reiner?
We've got about 35 items that we need to progress through undergraduate change in courses and change in new programs by the catalog deadline. We're meeting weekly to accomplish that. I have every reason to think that we'll be successful.
Thank you. Sada, Sandra?
We've been working on... this academic year, we've approved 10 new developmental level courses. Some are developmental English in the goal of aligning the English alignment across the state with the other campuses. So those course descriptions are in line with Anchorage and Juneau. And we've been sort of working with Curricular Affairs on the grade appeals policy and the appeals policy for academic decisions. And in general, we're working on placement issues. So there's still a Board of Regents would like to see the placement aligned between the three universities. And it is in English, but it's not in math yet. And so there's some work to be done in that direction. And we're updating our committee membership based on the new bylaws.
Oh, thank you. Questions for any of them, any of the above? Okay. FDAI, Franz?
we continue to work on the course evaluation system, tracking performance and working on feedback that we get from faculty. So please, if you have feedback, constructive feedback, we are very willing to receive those. So there's information online. You can send emails either to me or to Andrea Ferrante. We have regular meetings, and we try to follow up on them and sort of work on the system to make it work as best as it can for this university. And another thing that we are taking on is the faculty mentoring, status of the faculty mentoring program.
Thank you, Franz. Any questions for Franz?
Franz?
Yep.
Has there been discussion about putting together some university-wide incentive to do the evaluations? Or is it going to be left to the department or the course?
Yeah, so there have been discussions. There have been various options thrown out. We have decided to track for a semester or two what the response rates look like to make a decision on whether or not to go for. So there's no incentive, really, that finds general approval. There's a whole range of things that you can do and that have worked in various schools, but they will be addressed if the response rates are not are too low. And so currently they're lower than they were with the paper-based survey, but they're higher than they were with the online survey, so we're sort of in between. And they're widely spread, and some of them have 100%, we have some of them have very close to 0%. So we keep tracking those, and we try to analyze, you know, if we see any patterns in which classes are usually reviewed with less response rates and which with higher. And so
well, one thing I was thinking is this question about whether, you know, there's always the faculty are going to say that we're getting more negative comments now than we did before, mm-hmm. and that maybe there's some way to incentivize everybody, including the people that have no bad comments, that have positive comments, to respond. So I'm just... And actually, the very first, right out of the gate, the first thing my student said is there an incentive to do this?
Ah, okay.
So that was their first response to the whole new system. So I would encourage you to consider having something that would encourage everybody to participate.
So Kathy, what was the incentive when we had paper-based reviews? I mean, did we have any?
Well, but you couldn't get out.
Well, I don't think so, but it was right there. You know, you didn't have anything else to do with that 15 minutes, so you did it. But
but one could easily not do anything, right?
Right, and but it was all sitting there in front of you. So I think that there was – this is just the comment from the students. The first thing they said is, what's in it for me?
I do have one question as well. So I did have several students make a comment to me that the window was very short in which they could access these last semester, like it was only a 1 week or a 10-day window, and they were wondering if at this semester could they get the thing a week earlier because they said they were very busy working on finals, and so they had less sort of free time if they had had a bigger window, not after they had seen their grades or anything, but maybe earlier, that if they would have had more time, maybe you would have a higher response rate. Have you thought about that for this semester?
Yeah, that can be discussed. I don't think this has come up yet. It's the way this is timed is relative to the class length. So depending on if you have a full semester class, then the amount of time that you get the surveys early is longer than if you have a shorter class. We can certainly change the numbers if that's something that people think is desirable. I think this year there was also a little bit of a system glitch because it was the first full implementation. Oh, right. So this year the surveys were in the fall. The surveys were released two days or so later than initially planned because of an issue with the system that needed to be resolved, because that was the first round, the first full implementation of the system. So we anticipate at least slightly earlier release of the forms this year around in the spring semester.
Okay, thank you, Franz. Donnie from GAC?
GAC is primarily working on approving course changes and program changes and deletions and additions. We have been rather concerned to see the situation with graduate student health insurance, and we lobbied to have Mike come and speak to the Senate today so that you would all be aware of it as well. And I'll just add a little information, maybe anecdotal. I guess, but we had our graduate student representative, Mitch Reed, went on the ACA to see what the cost of health insurance would be if he was going to try to get a policy through the ACA rather than through the university. And it was substantially more expensive and covered substantially less than what the current program is doing. So I think that you should be aware that changes to the graduate student health insurance program are likely to have big impacts on the graduate students. It's not like it's simple, oh, yeah, they can get the same thing on the ACA. At least it doesn't seem that way now. It's a little complicated because what they get depends with the ACA, how much it costs depends a lot on what their income level is and what the subsidies are. But I think it could potentially have a strong impact on our graduate program if the university was to have to decide to stop covering graduate students.
Thank you. Any questions for her? Is Jessica around? Jessica Cherry? No. Julie Casquio? No. Orion, you want to have a comment?
We're trying to figure out how to meet our new obligation to deliver minutes for ADCOM to you. So we'll figure out how to get those. We have this new obligation to deliver minutes from ADCOM to you, and we're trying to figure out when and how to get that out to you. We have a Google Doc, and then at some point we have to share that with you.
Okay, so any other comments, questions?
Move to adjourn.
Okay, thank you.
This is unprecedented.
You say you had a good time. Okay, we are there for all that work.